Our first responsibility is to keep Americans safe. And the threat that you could go outside on your patio one night to water the plants or chat with a neighbor and get a single mosquito bite, and that could change your life forever, that's a threat we need to do everything in our power to minimize.
This is Dan Diamond, and you're listening to Pulse Check. The most frightening story in healthcare right now could be the spread of Zika virus, the mosquito-borne disease that's currently spreading across the Americas and linked to birth defects in infants. And Tom Frieden, as head of the CDC, is grappling with how to fight it and how to balance that effort against a dozen other key priorities. We talked with Frieden today about his public health agenda, not just Zika, but lessons from Ebola and other public health efforts that CDC is unveiling too. Frieden had been the pioneering health commissioner in New York City, putting Mayor Michael Bloomberg's initiatives into place, taking on the tobacco industry. And Bloomberg has called Frieden one of the best hires he ever made and said he's absolutely fearless. And I think you'll find, listening to today's conversation, that Frieden isn't scared of taking on big topics and also of infectious diseases. You'll find time cues in the podcast notes that will take you to what we discussed. Please remember to share the podcast either on iTunes, Stitcher, whatever podcast app you listen to and use, and write reviews. That's very helpful for new listeners to discover us. And in a bonus today, I grabbed a few minutes with my colleague, Nancy Cook, who's been tracking how healthcare is playing on the campaign, and specifically how opioids have become an unexpected issue on the trail. You'll hear that after the interview. And with that, here's Dr. Frieden. I was thinking about how the president gets his daily report on terrorism and threats to the economy. You are constantly scrubbed in on infectious disease threats and outbreaks around the world. How terrified are you, Dr. Frieden, on a daily basis?
Well, the fact is we have warning systems around the world, but they're not perfect. So diseases spread, and the real risk is that they spread before we realize that they're getting out of control. That's what happened with Ebola. Zika has been a completely unprecedented threat. So the things that worry me are not the things we know about, but the things we don't know about.
That's a wonderfully diplomatic answer, but I want to push you just a little bit more. If I knew what you knew, I think I would be in a steady state of panic every day. Have you just gotten accustomed to knowing that there are outbreaks in West Africa, things that could threaten the United States? How have you trained yourself to tolerate that amount of risk?
One of the characteristics of working in public health is that you see lives and faces behind numbers. So every day we see the fact that there are people dying from conditions that could have been prevented. Some of them are infectious, some of them are not. The things that make us most concerned are the possibility of a flu pandemic. In 1918, 1919, that killed more than 50 million people around the world. So if you're talking about the big one, that's the one that has us all most concerned, and we still don't have the ideal tools to fight it.
It strikes me that you have to walk a balance between informing the public of the risk and putting our system on alert, but at the same time, not pushing people toward panic. How do you strike that balance?
You always want to tell the truth. You always want to tell people what you know, when you know it, what you don't know, for what you don't know, what you're doing to find it out, and to the extent possible, give people concrete things to do. So you're not just feeding into a free-floating anxiety, but saying, listen, here's what you can do about it. So with Zika, if you're pregnant, don't go to a place where Zika is spreading. If you're in a place where Zika is spreading and you're pregnant, protect yourself against mosquito bites. And for men who travel to places where Zika is spreading, if your partner is pregnant, use a condom.
So I want you to know, and you've probably heard this before, when my friends heard that we were going to be sitting down with you, to a person they said, you have the best radio voice in the most soothing way, so perhaps that also helps communicate the message. But maybe a more serious question around Zika, because you've brought it up, and this is one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you this week. Where are we when it comes to knowing about the Zika virus? I've heard you talk about it at various briefings over the past 4 to 5 months. It seems like while we don't have the funding yet to fight it, there have been breakthroughs on understanding what the threat actually is.
We have literally been learning more every day about Zika. but there's still a lot we don't know. And the bottom line is very clear. We need to do everything in our power to protect pregnant women so that we reduce the number of infants born with birth defects.
And what you're speaking to, just to be clear for listeners, is the risk of microcephaly in infants.
It's now proven, and it's the first time it's ever happened. This is unprecedented, that a mosquito bite can cause a terrible birth defect. That's what Zika does. It's a horrific situation where the virus infects the mosquito. The mosquito infects the pregnant woman, and the virus then enters the pregnant woman's bloodstream and hones in a target on the infant's developing brain and destroys the brain cells.
It's horrifying.
It is. It is. And I just feel so for the women and the families who have to deal with this. I was sitting next to a woman in Puerto Rico because we were doing some focus groups with women, and there had been a misperception among some that women were not that concerned about it. Every woman we talked to who was pregnant was very concerned and wanted to know what she could do. And I asked the group, are you concerned? And this woman in a tattered T-shirt sitting next to me said, of course I'm concerned. If my baby is born unable to feed himself and care for himself, the rest of my life I'll be caring for him. And when I die, I'll be worried who's going to take care of him.
The human toll of Zika virus is scary. And one reason we're talking today, just to put a little context around this, because as you said, Doctor, we're learning more every day. This is Wednesday afternoon in Washington, D.C. Zika virus spreading across the Americas. There are hundreds of cases of pregnant women suspected to have Zika virus in the states and the territories. CDC last week revised the methodology a bit to make it more clear who would be exposed. Your agency's position is we are at the start of a looming threat. The mosquito season is coming in the South and the Gulf Coast areas. Where do you see the Zika virus fight going in the next 2 to 3 months?
Well, with Zika, we have some things that we know will work. We have other things that we have to try.
What do we know works?
Well, we know if you don't travel to a place where Zika is spreading, you're not going to get it. We know if you don't have sexual contact without a condom with someone who might have Zika, you're not going to get it.
So stay home and don't have any social...
No, we're talking specifically about pregnant women. And we know in Puerto Rico that there's a major challenge because in Puerto Rico, they've been dealt a bad hand by nature in terms of Zika and the virus that spreads it. So we need to pull out all the stops there to protect as many women as possible. If you step back, it's very rare that we have the opportunity to prevent birth defects by the dozens, hundreds, or thousands. This is really unusual. We have at CDC a National Center for Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities, and the people in that center have spent 30 years working in this area. And they tell me they have never seen a situation as urgent as this.
That urgency doesn't seem to be coming across when getting funding to fight Zika virus. We've tracked this at Politico. The request that the White House made was for $1.9 billion in emergency funding 4 months ago, almost. The Senate has come up with a compromise package of $1.1 billion. The House, as we sit here on Wednesday, last week passed a $622 million package. What I would love to know from you, Doctor, because you know this as well as anyone, what do we lose by only getting $600 million to fight Zika virus versus the full White House request of $1.9 billion?
The big picture is that in the end, Congress did the right thing on Ebola. And I hope that in the end, they will do the right thing on Zika. But we don't have a lot of time. The window of opportunity is closing. And there are two issues that have to be resolved. First, we have to pay back the emergency money that we borrowed to deal with Zika. And we took money from emergency preparedness grants to states around the U.S., not because that's unimportant money, but because that was about the only money we had.
And just to clarify, so the White House staked a few hundred million dollars from existing funds that were being used to fight infectious disease, being used by state health departments as kind of a goodwill gesture, put that toward the Zika fight.
It wasn't a goodwill gesture. It was the only place we could go for money. So it was a way of getting started. And quite frankly, when some of the planning was going on in the supplemental request, I asked at one meeting, how long is this going to take? Because, you know, we need the money quickly. And I was told, oh, it'll be very quick, probably, you know, maybe 3 months. And my jaw literally dropped. It's like 3 months is an eternity when it comes to stopping an outbreak. So we reprogrammed money. That money needs to go back to what it was meant for by Congress initially. The second problem is we have to start the work now that will take many years. That includes work to understand what the impacts are on women and children, work to better stop mosquitoes because we don't have great tools. If we use our existing mosquito control tools better together, we think we can do a lot, and we need new ones, and better ways to diagnose the infection and ultimately a vaccine. All of those things are going to take time. The sooner we start, the faster we go, the sooner we'll get a solution.
You said something particularly interesting to me, and that's the comparison with the Ebola fight. We talked with Ron Klain, who you know well, last week, the Ebola czar in the White House, about how this is kind of a bigger story. In October 2014, November, I think, actually, the president asked for $6 billion in funding. Congress gave 90% of that within 5 weeks. Why is it so different now?
I can't answer that. All I can say is I'm encouraged by the fact that there are folks in both houses of Congress on both sides of the aisle who get that this is an emergency. After all, look at the definition of an emergency under the law. Unanticipated, and this is unprecedented, potentially catastrophic, and for a family with a child with a birth defect, it is not potentially catastrophic, it is, and permanent, and nothing is more permanent than brain damage.
Let me tell you what some Republican members have told me. I'm curious for your reaction. Though I feel like I might be able to predict some of it. One difference between Zika and Ebola is that Ebola was known to be fatal, where Zika, we're still learning things. So I agree with you, it is horribly scary what it can do. The second piece is that the Ebola funds were given at a time of crisis for the country. That crisis moment is not here, and some Republicans, looking backwards, have said, maybe we funded too much for Ebola. Why do we need to run and fund more? This kind of request happens over and over again. How does that argument strike you?
Well, first off, on the Ebola funding, I can only speak to the CDC part of it. We asked for $1.8 billion, and we are spending $1.8 billion to keep Americans safe. So I don't think Congress funded too much on Ebola. I think they did the right thing. And it's very important that that doesn't get undone now to fight the next outbreak or epidemic. We don't need epidemic attention deficit disorder. The head of our vector control program has said that with vector-borne diseases, nobody ever does anything until it's too late. And that's one of the real challenges we have with mosquito-borne disease. To get a good handle on mosquitoes, you need a system in place. You need to track them, even in the years they're not causing problems. You need to improve the way you control them. And all of those things are needed, but they may not be as headline-grabbing as Ebola or another problem.
What do you hate more, mosquitoes or tobacco companies?
Well, I probably shouldn't say this, but they're both vehicles of mass destruction.
I'm glad you said that. But no one would hear. It's just the two of us talking in this conference room. One other thought on the Ebola-Zika connection, which Ron wrestled with last week, too. Is it possible that we were just too successful at fighting the Ebola outbreak? The panic moment was here, the funding came, and then, lo and behold, no other Americans got sick. If the Ebola outbreak had gone worse, do you think there would be more momentum to fight Zika today?
It's important to understand what did and didn't happen with Ebola. The Ebola epidemic should not have happened. If West Africa had had the kind of basic public health systems that Uganda, DRC, Kenya, Ethiopia have, they should have been able to find it quicker, stop it, and we wouldn't have had a $5 billion bill. We wouldn't have had tens of thousands of people dying from Ebola and from other things because the healthcare system shut down. But Ebola could have been much, much worse. It came within days of getting completely out of control in Lagos, Nigeria. Lagos has the same population as the three West African countries combined and 10 times as many travelers.
And I've read about how folks stepped in to do the contact tracing and on-the-ground command and control to lock that down. One of the lessons I've heard you say from the Ebola fight is every country needs to be able to detect and fight these outbreaks, but at the same time, the world needs to be ready to surge in when there is a shortfall.
That's exactly right. And we need to move forward on both of those lines, strengthening countries because, frankly, it'll be cheaper, more efficient, and more sustainable if countries do it themselves. And that's what we do at CDC. We build capacity for laboratory work, epidemiology work, rapid response teams at the local level. And with some of the Ebola dollars, we've been able to scale that up. I was just reviewing, for example, a very encouraging situation in Uganda where we've helped them control yellow fever. So they have an outbreak now. They found it sooner. They stopped it sooner. They rapidly sequenced it, and they know it's not the Angola strain. So they're controlling it before it hits the headlines. We need to continue to scale up that kind of program, but the world does need to be able to surge in faster when a country's capacities are stretched.
Well, if the U.S. capacity to fight Zika virus doesn't come through because of lack of funding, who is going to surge in and help us?
I don't think we can wait for anyone else.
One final thought on Zika, and then I want to take this conversation to some of the other many like priorities that you're working on. We spoke with Farzad Mostashari, another person that you know well who worked with you in New York City. He said that you had an incredible way of clarifying what the issues were in front of you, that the goal was to fight the problems that affected the most people. I'm paraphrasing a bit. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, something in that vein. CDC has said that Zika is probably only going to affect hundreds of Americans this year, maybe thousands. Should our focus be instead then on hypertension and tobacco, which are affecting huge numbers of Americans in contrast to Zika threat?
We're fortunate to have a healthcare and a public health system that can do more than one thing at a time. We can walk and chew gum. So it's not an either-or situation. Our first responsibility is to keep Americans safe. And the threat that you could go outside on your patio one night to have, to water the plants or chat with a neighbor and get a single mosquito bite and that could change your life forever, that's a threat we need to do everything in our power to minimize. And it's a new threat that we're learning more about every day. We think we know what will happen with Zika if it behaves as dengue and chikungunya, two other viruses spread by the same mosquito, if it behaves the same way. But we're not certain of that. And we need to do everything possible to keep Americans safe. And for that, we need Congress to do their part.
So I'm going to test you, Doctor, now on your ability to walk and chew gum, at least verbally. One of the other big priorities from CDC this year has been confronting the opioid epidemic. And there has been some good news. There was a report just a few days ago that for the first time in decades, the opioid epidemic, at least the prescription, number of prescriptions for opioids, seems to be going down. Where are we on the fight against overprescription of opioids and the casualties that then renders?
We've been sounding the alarm on this since shortly after I became CDC director.
Which was in 2009.
Yes. And what we've seen is a horrific trend where prescriptions for opiates have increased fourfold and deaths from opiates have increased fourfold. We're now seeing some of that evolve into an epidemic of heroin and non-pharmaceutically produced fentanyl. So we're seeing a real challenge with the addictiveness of these drugs. And the numbers continue to go up. In fact, as of 2014, all but two states had continued increases in deaths from overdose. But we are getting a sense of what can be done. And there is certainly bipartisan, broad support throughout society for doing more. One of the things that we did recently was to issue a guideline for treatment of chronic pain.
Yes.
Trying to get things into a better balance. We're not talking about people with palliative care. We're not talking about people who've just had surgery or been in an acute situation where they're in agony. In those situations, opiates are incredibly important.
Yes.
But they have huge risks. And the risks are well proven. They're addictive. And you can get just a few doses and be addicted for the rest of your life. And they are easy to overdose on. You take just a few too many pills and you can stop breathing and die. Those are proven risks. For chronic pain, the proven benefits are not there. In fact, there's even some evidence as we looked at it that if you take opiates, it may kind of upregulate your pain reception. So
right.
You may actually feel more pain. Not only do you not do better, you may do worse with it. Now, that's not saying there isn't a role for some patients, but it is saying we are in the wrong place right now. We need the best treatment for patients' pain. That may mean other medications. That may mean physical therapy. That may mean exercise therapy. There are lots of things we can do to reduce pain. Pain is a terrible thing. We want to minimize it. We don't however want to do that at the risk of killing people.
Given that we're at a point, too many opioid prescriptions, widespread opioid misuse, I'm curious how we got here. And from my vantage point at Politico, I talked to societies, medical societies, and different organizations that have passed the buck a bit and said, we didn't know that this was a problem and we weren't the ones to blame, not looking to find a scapegoat, but more looking to just understand what was the path that led us here. From your perspective, doctor, how did America end up with this opioid crisis?
I think there are a lot of causes, and I don't think there's a single bad actor here who made it happen. There's a drug company that marketed inaccurately, but there's also, quite frankly, in our society, the sense that if I've got a problem, there must be a pill for it. And we see this with antibiotics as well. Sometimes the best medicine isn't the most medicine. It's not the broadest spectrum medicine. It's the right medicine, or sometimes no medicine.
Right.
And sometimes our system just makes it easiest for doctors to prescribe something and patients to ask for something. And a whole series of societal and healthcare and industrial pressures led to this prescribing level that is really far in excess of what it should be.
Thinking about what else is in your portfolio, I love reading the statistical reports that come out from the CDC. So my kudos to your team on that. But there was a report just this week on key measures of obesity and smoking. On the one hand, incredibly positive. The smoking rate continues to plunge. I think 15% of adults are now smokers, which is probably still 15% too many. But compared to where we were 20 years ago, that's dramatic reduction. On the flip side, obesity rate is now seemingly higher than ever. 30% of adult Americans are obese. My question to you, are Americans getting healthier? Have we reached a plateau where we're not seeing the same breakthroughs, especially given other reports that white mortality is flatlined or even reversing?
The smoking news is really good news. This is the lowest smoking rate ever documented in the U.S., and it reflects millions of Americans who no longer smoke and who aren't going to die from a smoking-related cause. It's going to help us with healthcare costs also, because someone who quits smoking costs about $1,000 less to care for per year than a smoker who continues to smoke. And a kid who never starts smoking costs a lot less to care for than someone who smokes. If you look at the trends in the U.S., there are only a few things getting worse. Really, prescription drug overdose, hepatitis C, and suicide are all going up as causes of death, and you never like to see anything go up as a cause of death. So we need to focus not only on the causes of death that are increasing, but on the populations in which they're increasing, and focus prevention and interventions to those populations. I think overall health is improving, but it's not improving equally, and that's a huge problem for our country. The inequalities in our health status are huge, and most people would be surprised about the leading single contributor to health inequality in the U.S. It's heart disease. Heart disease continues to be the leading preventable cause of death. That's why we focused on controlling blood pressure, on doing things in society as a whole that will reduce heart disease. It's the largest contributor to the difference in black-white life expectancy, and it's the largest contributor to preventable deaths in this country. And preventing it shouldn't cost a lot of money. In the U.S., we spend trillions of dollars on healthcare, and yet only 54% of Americans who have high blood pressure have it under control. There's no single thing you could do other than quit smoking if you smoke that will help your health more than controlling your blood pressure if it's high.
Sometimes I wonder if it's a little bit like Groundhog Day to be in public health, where you have to deliver these messages over and over again. I've heard you say some of these things for years, and there has been major progress, but these are still big issues, too.
But we're still learning new things, and we're making progress. So blood pressure control is increasing, not as fast as I'd like, but it's increasing. Smoking rates are decreasing, not as fast as I'd like, but they're decreasing. And there is a science of public health. We're learning new ways to be more effective with the two limited dollars we have. So the TIPS campaign from former smokers on tobacco cessation prevented a death for less than $3,000 and extended life for less than $400 per year of life extended. These are tremendous best buys. They're hundreds of times more cost-effective than lots of other interventions that we think are great buys.
Speaking of learning new things, I wanted to wrap up our conversation with a quick lightning round. I know you are well positioned to answer cogently and cleverly. So are you game?
I'm ready.
Okay. First question, favorite fictional doctor?
Oh.
And I asked this because I was watching Veep this weekend and they had a CDC doctor on. No, did not reflect you at all. It was just a random CDC doctor, but I was thinking, God, Dr. Frieden would have been a better choice for this role.
Well, I thought Lawrence Fishburne in Contagion was pretty good.
Contagion is a terrifying movie, by the way.
Contagion is the most accurate description of an outbreak I've seen in the movies. They portray an epidemic intelligence service officer. It's quite well done.
You know, I went to see it on a date with someone else who worked in healthcare. Worst date movie possible. we left and basically stood 5 feet from each other. You play squash. Great game. How good are you at holding the tee?
Not as good as I should be.
You were a city health commissioner in New York. Which cities right now are doing the most interesting and appealing things? I wanted to ask you for one, but I know that might be hard to choose.
Well, really, it isn't just one. We've seen Chicago drive down rates of healthcare-associated infections. We've seen cities look at things like how to encourage people to walk by changing the way they build sidewalks or encourage bicycling and active living. You've seen some tobacco control and anti-obesity activities in different places. To me, the bottom line is, what are the results? So I want to wait to see what all of these great, exciting things do in terms of a health outcome. Then we can point to that. We know in New York City that with reducing the smoking rate, improving treatment of HIV, improving colon cancer screening and other things, we increased life expectancy by 3 years.
Most important disease we didn't talk about on this podcast?
I would have to go back to high blood pressure. High blood pressure is the forgotten killer. And the fact is, far too many people are going to have strokes, heart attacks, kidney problems that are really preventable because we can reduce the number of people with high blood pressure and we can much better treat those who have it.
Last question. You famously rolled back a number of changes that your predecessor had made to CDC when you stepped in here. What change that you've made do you want to stick?
Well, I think what makes CDC one of, if not the most trusted federal agency, is that we stick to the science. And so we've deepened the rigor of the science at CDC, our laboratory science, our epidemiology, our communication of that science, and our ability to work with state, local, and international partners to get that science translated into saving lives and protecting Americans.
Dr. Frieden, thank you so much for being here. I'm sure we'll hear more from you this summer as the Zika virus fight continues.
Thank you.
Hey, this is Dan Diamond, and if you like Politico and Pulse Check, and I'm sure you do if you've made it this far in today's episode, I wanted to tell you about an upcoming event that's of interest. It's on June 9th, Politico's roundtable Outside In on how tech and telemedicine are changing home health. It's going to be at the W Hotel in Washington, D.C. We've got a series of guests who are both inside politics as well as outsiders working to change the system. If you'd like to learn more, go to politico.com/outsideIn. We'd love to see you in person. And now here's my colleague, Nancy Cook, with an update on how healthcare is playing on the campaign trail and how opioids have emerged as a surprising issue. I'm here now with my colleague and friend, Nancy Cook. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, thanks for having me, Dan.
Nancy, we just came from talking to Tom Frieden about a number of public health issues, including opioids and how they've risen in the public health policy agenda. You've reported on how opioids have become an issue on the campaign trail. Can you catch us up on what you've learned from the campaigns around the country?
Sure. So the opioid epidemic so far is really playing out in Senate races in particular. It was something that the presidential candidates talked a lot about when they were in New Hampshire, which is a state that has been heavily hit by the opioid epidemic. But now it's really playing out in a handful of Senate races where some very vulnerable moderate Republican senators are trying to use the issue as a way to say that they're very bipartisan and they're able to pass legislation.
And to be clear, this is new, that Republicans would be seizing on the opioid epidemic as a campaign issue.
Absolutely. And it's something that really speaks to what's happening in 2016. Republicans are looking, particularly in the down ballot races, for any opportunity they can to talk about ways in which they can govern, to talk about issues in which they appear empathetic to voters, and to show that they can pass bipartisan legislation, particularly at a time when Americans feel like Congress is too partisan, it's bickering, and they can't get things done.
And to be clear, we're talking about Senator Rob Portman, for example, in Ohio, who's in a tough race there.
Exactly.
This is a tricky question, and I've heard this from my sources. I'm sure you've heard this, too. The opioid epidemic didn't become a big political issue until it started affecting white Americans. Drug problems and drug misuse in America is not a new issue. How do you see that, having tracked these campaigns and the message that they're trying to get across?
That's absolutely true. I mean, one of the states in which this is really playing out is New Hampshire, which is one of the sort of least diverse states in the country. And it's playing out with Senator Kelly Ayotte, who is running against the Democratic governor, Maggie Hassan. And New Hampshire has just been decimated by opioid abuse. And there's tons of people, a lot of white people, old people, young people, rural city people in New Hampshire. It's affecting everyone. And the candidates really want to get on top of this because it's affecting such a wide swath of people, perhaps in a way that drug use hadn't before or hasn't in recent years, at least.
In terms of the opioid epidemic and the attention on it, are there any surprising players, even beyond these Republican candidates for office, that are weighing in on the public health challenge?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because one really interesting thing that's happened is this Karl Rove back group has actually spent over $1 million. They spent about $1.2 million on paid media, a bunch of commercials in New Hampshire on Kelly Ayotte's reelection campaign. And those are commercials that have specifically focused just on the opioid epidemic. And that's really unusual to have paid commercials on TV, not talking about healthcare at large, not talking about repealing Obamacare, which is a standard line for Republicans and really red meat to Republican voters, but something that's talking about her role in passing Senate legislation to fund and fight opioid addiction. And that's sort of a really interesting thing that these political players are jumping into this arena.
And when Karl Rove is turning his powers on an issue like the opioid epidemic, that's probably a good thing for fighting the opioid epidemic, given his communication savvy.
And even in even in the tight races, there was a congressional recess in mid-May, and all the candidates, for instance, on that week-long recess when they were home, all did sort of opioid-related events, at local hospitals, community centers. It's something that they're just talking about in their home districts quite extensively.
Opioids are just one healthcare issue coming off the campaign trail. You've followed some of these campaigns around. What are the big healthcare issues right now, and maybe new ones that have emerged in the 2016 race?
Well, I would say at this point in the race, we're in this slightly unusual point in that it's a little bit quieter than it's been for the last several months. The next primary is in California on June 7th, but there's, it's a quiet period where I feel like Clinton and Trump broadly are settling into this sense of how they're going to attack each other politically, and they're sort of figuring that out, and there's a lot of internal campaign dynamics in both sides sort of sorting out these messaging issues. So I would say because of that, healthcare has really taken second or even third place. It's not sort of a policy issue that's coming up, but then again, not a lot of policy issues are coming up. The most recent thing we heard was from Clinton in mid-May, where she talked about possibly expanding Medicare and opening it up so that people age 55 or 50 would potentially be able to buy into the program. But that's really the last that we've heard a major healthcare policy platform. And one thing that I've been tracking is what Trump, for instance, is saying about public health issues like Zika or opioids. And he's been really quiet on that front. He's been quiet on all healthcare fronts.
Weirdly quiet compared to how vocal he is on basically everything else. One of your favorite stories that I read this year, Nance, was on the advisors to Hillary Clinton, the healthcare team that she has around her. Might we be able to predict, if there is a President Clinton next year, what her priorities would be based on some of the folks who are in her circle?
Sure. Well, so she has a team of advisors that have just been advising her forever. And the story that I wrote maybe a month or so ago really talked about them. Chris Jennings is one of the key people. He's not formally with the campaign, but he's really running all of the healthcare policy.
And Chris Jennings, who dates back to the first Clinton, well, at this point, the only Clinton White House, but also helped with the Obama health reform effort for a brief time. He was in the White House, I think, for a few months in 2010.
Exactly, for about 6 months. But he goes back with the Clintons, way back with them. Both Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton have deep ties with him. And he's sort of the person in Washington, D.C. that they run all healthcare ideas through. He's hosting a series of working groups with different people around town about specific issues that come up. But I would say sort of broadly, the healthcare issues this time aren't just about repealing Obamacare, you know, should we keep it in place, should we not? The issue that's really, at least the Clintons are really going to be talking about is affordability and how to make healthcare more affordable.
And I should clarify my misspeak. Jennings was in the White House in 2013 and 2014. There was no Affordable Care Act in 2009, 2010 for him to be implemented.
Yes.
We're self-correcting on this podcast.
Yes.
Nancy, thanks so much for the rundown and thanks for making time to do this.
Of course, anytime.
That's it for Pulse Check this week. Thank you to my producer, Bridget Mulcahy, editorial assistant, Mary Lee. You can find our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast apps. Just search for Pulse Check. Email ddiamond@politico.com with suggestions of who we should have on upcoming episodes. And we'll be back again next week.